Greetings, you happily miserable accursed. David Hurley here with your ever-loving political panel, Scott Reed, Jordan Leichnitz, and Corey Tonight. We'll start with this Apple ratings and review shout-out from the very delicious-sounding Kareem Cheese. We want longer episodes. It's okay to go longer than an hour. It's desirable, even. Well, thank you, Mr. or Mrs. Cheese. We appreciate the sentiment. But we're lucky to have these guys for the hour we do, and there are real challenges with going longer. Jordan has to give her NDP internet to another family member right at the 61-minute mark. Corey's hair gel only lasts an hour before it hardens and cuts another social program. And one of Scott's 16 sons has a tournament to play in every day of every week and has to be driven to Windsor or Goderich or upstate New York. All right, here's the show today. Our cursed clipping is sure to warm Corey's heart. It's Robert Benzie writing in the Star about how this latest PC ad blitz is helping Doug Ford and hurting Bonnie Crombie. But we're going to start with a roundup on the budget presented last Tuesday. Was it a political success or a political failure? And then we'll get into it. Premier Andrew Fury out in Newfoundland and the challenges of running against your own brand. Finally, it's Mr. Pinsent with our Hey Yous. Jordan, Corey, Scott, we're about 9 hours from the start of Passover. How are you?
Good.
Yeah.
I'm not good this morning. I was complaining earlier that I'm grumpy. I'm moving house for like the 12th time in 12 months.
Wait, really?
We have renos starting.
Corey's downwardly mobile.
Yeah, and, I was going to say, God, the housing crisis in Toronto has really taken a turn.
His capital inclusions rate has hit him fucking right between the eyes.
I had about 400 hot dogs and everything else in my freezer in a fucking cart, pushing it down Yonge Street at 7:30 in the morning because our kitchen's getting torn out. I had to empty out the fridge and take it to the Airbnb we're staying in. And dodging zombies about every five steps. It's fucking terrible is what it is. It was.
And here I was thinking grumpy that Corey had taken a volunteer gig doing street outreach.
Well, there was a lot of hot dogs and ramen noodles, but I'm not sure that would pass the nutritional test for even the homeless. But
no, but once you put your famous chili on top of those wieners, then you've got something.
Then you got something. But yeah. That was frozen. I'm not sure it would have gone well in that state.
Jordan, how are you?
I'm good. I finally have a sports anecdote. Because it intersected with the labor union world.
CFL.
That's right. They've joined the Canadian Labor Congress. So that's my kind of house of labor right there. So I look forward to I'm thinking particularly about Saskatchewan football fans. Their newfound reconnection with the labor movement based on this. So I thought that was kind of a good news thing for the labor movement last week in Canada.
You know, Scott, the labor movement's never had a decent offensive line.
No, I was going to say, and you know, you got to make sure you don't let any of those American negotiators come up here and think they've got one more down to work with, only to realize at the last minute they're finished.
Yeah, that sounds very familiar.
All right, let's get to it. There's been a week of budget coverage and analysis. If you want a deep dive into the substance, I would encourage you to check out the Hurley Burley with Sean Spear, Jennifer Robson, and Tyler Meredith. The column pages are full of hot takes about whether this budget gets the Liberals off the political mat or if nothing can. I'm reserving judgment on that point, you guys. I think the elements of the budget should have greater support than the Liberals do now, and therefore could provide some lift to Liberal support. The question everybody has on their mind is whether people are still willing to support Trudeau even if they agree with him anymore. And the other question I have is whether the right people will hear this. Their intended audience of Gen Z and millennials have not been reading the newspaper accounts or watching the At Issue panel about this. So for my money, data sciences is going to have to do a hell of a bang-up job of communicating these initiatives to the people who are most likely to respond positively to them. This has to be a direct communication exercise about some of the programs and some of the initiatives in this budget. So for that reason, I'm prepared to let this gestate for a bit before calling it. But Jordan, what's your take?
I thought it was a bit of a flop, to be honest. I think in part that has to do with the context that the Liberals created in the lead up. They did do a very good rollout ahead of the budget, and that gave them, I think, a certain momentum going into budget day. But the framing of the budget and what they put down, I don't think it didn't go big enough. It was too small, right? So I think the challenge is that they haven't yet been able to create the fight that they were looking for with Poilievre on the capital gains tax. So the Conservatives, I think, are being pretty savvy in not entirely taking the bait on that. The Liberals laid a cunning trap and they caught a Doug Ford instead. So that's kind of fun. You know, you've ever done that. You put out a mouse trap and you're like, oh, look at that. That's not a mouse.
Hey, Freds, can you take me and my leg out of this trap, Freds? Corey, am I supposed to be in this trap?
So I expect Corey to launch an extrication mission after he's done our call with us today. And I think that, you know, part of the challenge there on, and I mean, I want to be clear, like on a policy level, I think the capital gains change, like, this is a good change. It was done very surgically. This was, by all accounts, I think, really smart policy, and the politics of it are pretty good. But you have to go a couple layers down into a pretty deep financial discussion about types of taxation and so on for people to get that. So I do wonder if the target audience is going to hear that message, particularly if the Conservatives don't take the bait. The other thing I thought was really interesting about the budget is that you heard the finance minister sort of articulating the philosophical basis of the fight that they want to have a little bit more clearly on budget day. So Freeland was out talking about, we're going to be an activist government. We're going to get in there. We're going to be an activist government. Now, I think the problem was that they did that without actually contrasting with the Conservatives. So it was a bit of a half critique. Like, they're half in on the strategy. They're sort of doing the positive politics thing, and we're going to just put this vision out and just let it sit out there in contrast with our opponents. But of course, there's no magic in that. Like, you have to prosecute the case. And what, just listening to all of the ministers out doing the interviews over the weekend, I really didn't hear that. I heard deep, wonky policy discussions. I heard a lot of defensiveness about the government's own record, but I didn't hear a really strong fight to the Conservatives about, what are you going to cut? Are you going to repeal this? What, you know, they'd set up these fights and then kind of failed to take it to over the finish line. But that was football, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Carrying it through there. I thought all in all, I don't know that this was really their best day, and I'm not super convinced by their execution of what appears to be their strategy in the day's sense. So maybe that will shift, but so far I don't think it was really a big win for them.
I'm a boy born of the prairies, and I've worked a lifetime in politics and polling. From these experiences, Hurley Burleyites, I can tell you unequivocally, the West is not the East. Ah, you're smart. You know that. For a few weeks now, I've been talking about CRTC hearings, exploring options for mandating wholesale fiber internet to the premises. Should they do it? If so, where? And how to do it in a way that best promotes competition, so Canadians have choice and affordability. Our presenting sponsor, TELUS, presented at those hearings. One of their key points? Well, the West is not the East. Or one broad national mandate does not fit all regions equally. Evidence backs it up. As a result of the pre-existing mandates on copper and cable in Western Canada, subscribers to services provided by wholesalers have increased out there by 17% in the last 2 years. Competition in the West is flourishing in ways it simply is not in the East. Layer onto that, labor costs are 12% more expensive in Alberta and BC, how dispersed the population is, the mountainous terrain, and that fiber has to be buried in Alberta, making the network a hell of a lot more expensive to build, and the maxim holds true. Say it with me. The West is not the East. So, a short recap. A much more competitive landscape. Far higher costs to invest. Oh, and one last caution. There's been a fair bit of change in the West recently, with other policies and a major industry merger only a year old. The competitive realities are just beginning to take hold. So the CRTC would be wise to understand how any new mandate in the West would stack on top of those policies, eh? As for TELUS, they believe different regional conditions require a specifically tailored mandate before further intervention is settled on. All right, that's it. Stay tuned next week, Hurly Burlyites, for The North is Not the South. Kidding. Corey, how do you think it's going for the government?
I largely agree with what Jordan said. I think that they sort of fumbled the final piece, which I do agree was a trap for the Conservatives. I just think it was too small a trap to catch game that big. And I also think they probably weren't helped at all by David Dodge going out and creating expectations that there was going to be a lot more there. And that got some people in their base, I think, revved up and expectations calibrated at the wrong level. And then even for the business community, I think it's like, well, okay, that's not great, but it's not like at all as bad as what was being contemplated and projected out there. So I don't think they got the reaction, not only from the Conservatives, but from the larger business community. Like, there was some grumbling, but you know, I think for the most part, the reaction was muted compared to what it would have been if the David Dodge version of this these tax measures had come out. So yeah, I thought it was meek in terms of the policy side. I think, you know, a bit timid, and I think also in terms of the execution rhetorically. Like, I was surprised. Scott was surprised. We were all surprised watching the budget and then seeing the interview with Vashi and the finance minister, where she was given an opportunity to tee up on Polyev around these tax measures, and she basically took a pass. And I was surprised. So it made me wonder if there's a Bevin strategy and then there's a Freeland strategy. Are they the same strategy? Are they different?
Well, she's not a full-throated class warrior. That's evident from listening to her. And she's trying to minimize this thing, not accentuated, right? Like, she's trying to say it's a small amount of money from people who can really afford it. She's not hammering away at the class language.
Yeah, but I think you got to if you want to drive that wedge and have it punched through. And they chose not to, which makes it, I think, really easy for the Conservatives to just sidestep it. Like, you know, I think the response from the Conservatives is more or less, yeah, there go the Liberals raising taxes again without having to actually engage in the substance of those tax changes, and then just pivot right back to the carbon tax. And look, when you have a tax that affects 100% of people in the country, and then you have one that affects, you know, less than 1% of the country, I know which one I want to fight a campaign on. And they're making it real easy to have that be the carbon tax be the focal point. So I'd say at the end of this, all advantage Conservatives.
Let me just stick with you for a second, Corey, because I want to push on that last point. Because, I mean, I watched Melissa Lantzman on Question Period, which I watched because you and Scott are on. You know, I mean, that's why I watch Question Period. Oh. See what you guys have
you
to say.
You and 11 million other Canadians.
Take away the million. Me and 11 other people. If your mom's, hey, if your mom's watching.
Me and Corey. My mom.
What if your mom watches it twice? Does that count? It's 2 years.
I think in the CBC it does. I don't know what CTV does.
Like Corey's mom's there, like jazzing the the viewer numbers, hitting the refresh button.
So Vashi, and I think I'm saying that right.
Careful.
If not, you're going to hear from me in my
interview. This isn't a truck stop, and it's not 1977.
Vashi's pushing her on whether the Conservatives support this capital gains tax change or not. And she demurs, from saying it looks evasive. It looks like you know, but you don't want to say. It doesn't look like you don't know. And then finally she says, literally says to Vashi, right, we're going to axe the tax, build the homes, fight the crime, and fix the budget. That's not normal talk.
Churn the
butter.
It
doesn't come off.
Right? Fuck the glory hole. Like, it's just whatever. All right.
So, I mean, I don't know that is sustainable without some damage occurring over time. I'm back at you, Bert.
Well, look, I don't think there's a lot of damage there. Yeah, I'd be more worried if I were the Conservatives about what third parties are going to do, and have a bunch of well-intentioned, bumbling corporate types decide to go and run a campaign and put this in the window with the hope that it's going to help defeat it ultimately in the end. But I think the only thing that a big campaign like that would do is to push the Conservatives into to having support for the measure as opposed to opposition. Like, it's been really clear that the bigger strategic play for the Conservatives is to be the party of guys and gals in work boots more than suits and boardrooms. Like, it's a working class, middle class play that they're running, and that's, you know, I think excludes being the champion of the 0.1%ers. Like, you can't be both, and so if you have to pick which side you're going to come down on a measure like this, it's pretty obvious from a political standpoint. I think they prefer just not to talk about it, and I think that's largely what you're seeing. But if forced to, and I don't think it's going to be the Liberals or the media that are going to force them to do it. It would be, you know, as I say, some well-intentioned, ham-fisted corporate types that you know decide to do that. I don't know. Cue John Manley. Maybe Goldie Hyder. I don't know. Like, Jim Basile, what's he doing? Other than being a cautionary tale for tech entrepreneurs, I don't know. But like, it's folks like that you know, maybe Galen Weston. He'd probably be worse. But yeah, folks like that are going to be smart.
They've hidden him deep in some basement.
Yeah, like. Right.
Your 10 sweater vests. Don't come out.
It's like, I think that's more likely to force the issue higher up on the issue matrix is if people engage in that way. And I think if they want to see a conservative government, they would rethink those plans.
All right. So, Scott, right? You had sort of 5 or 6 days to watch this thing unfold. Is it unfolding as the government imagined it would?
Not well enough. I mean, like you, I was impressed and gradually won over by the deliberateness of the pre-budget rollout and its conscious effort to pursue a strategy, which I admired. Whether that strategy can win, I mean, partly it's got to do with the question you asked, which is that even a perfect strategy actually be effective in this circumstance? And people said, sorry, if it's coming from this quarter, I'm not listening. And so, that, you know, those questions. But what do you do about that? You can't just lay down and quit breathing. So I thought a couple of things. One, we've been talking about football. I'm going to switch to basketball because I thought budget day was the basketball equivalent of an ISO play, where they basically said, there's shitloads of stuff packed in here. We've told you stuff in advance, but it was an ISO play on the tax measure. And they were trying to lure the Conservatives into that sharp fight. They got the fight they wanted. They got it with economists and business types, and they got it with, you know, for one day with Ford. But they didn't get the opponent they want. They have not been able to get the Conservatives. I do think there's a consolation prize to date, and that is at least among the media and those that are plugged in and watching closely and are paying attention to question period, the awkward plainness with which the Conservatives are, as you guys highlighted, refusing to answer the question. I think that's been exposed. And I think that could have a conditioning effect going forward, where you're going to start to see the pressure ratcheted up on Polyev and the rank to say, sorry, you've got to answer some questions. Now, they'll resist that, but then that will make them look even worse, as it's obvious they're resisting and so forth. So there may be a lingering dividend from that, but they didn't get the fight they wanted so far. I don't agree with Corey. I think that the business community's reaction has been pretty voluble. I think it's still rolling. I think you may see some of those well-intended idiots put together a national campaign that will force a higher profile discussion on this measure. I'm not sure that the juice is out of this orange. And I think in terms of a matter of conflict. But again, you know, the Conservatives are going to have to be dumb enough to get drawn into it. They're going to have to lose
the rich
temper.
People for lower taxes coalition.
Exactly. Right. So
yeah, I mean, I agree with Scott. Like, these people are not gifted with a lot of self-awareness, so there is a very high chance that they will think that their opinion is politically valuable at the moment.
I think that part of it's still rolling, so we'll see. I also think there is a messenger challenge. You know, I don't want to pick on the scab, but I think it's a twofold. We talked about one half of it, and let's talk about the other. So one half is that even though this was the strategy and it was drawn up, and it's why I reacted so, and I reacted quite, I felt almost intemperately. I felt a little bit bad in the moment watching, doing the budget coverage special live.
It was frustrating. I was watching it. It was frustrating.
When I, as a partisan, when I was watching Vashi turn to Freeland and give her the question that Freeland, by her own design, was looking for, and then Freeland decides to just slide into meaningless slogans and avoid the fight and confrontation, it just absolutely stirred me, and so I kind of reacted. But then, you know, obviously she got back on track. They, you know, but she also, 2 days later, I saw another news conference. She was asked at a microphone, and she again, she just decided to pass on by and slide into blah blah blah. And so, as you say, David, there's a struggle within there. But the other half of it is that means it's left entirely to the prime minister. Because really, who gives a shit about the other ministers? They don't. If we're worried about whether this penetrates at all, it for sure doesn't penetrate if the finance minister isn't carrying it, other than the prime minister. So the prime minister is put back in this position, which is what 23% purchases you, of being a zone spear carrier. And so you see the prime minister carrying this fight. And he's making the class warfare argument. I'm also... My last thing I would say is...
Can I just interrupt and point out that having a trust fund baby making this argument on behalf of the government is maybe not the best spokesperson?
I hear this argument. I don't believe it. I mean, people may say that, but that's all a function of if you're in that argument, if that's your rebuttal on the bar stool, then you belong to the people who've said, I'm not listening to anything that Trudeau says. Like, I'm not going to forego the argument because somebody might say, well, wait a second, didn't you inherit $1 million worth of fucking paintings or whatever? Like, they need this argument. They need this fight. So, like, if it's an imperfect messenger, then whatever. But the last thing I would say, though, is there's a missing message. And Jordan mentioned it. Yes, there's the tax fight, but there's also the argument where they should be rushing to microphones. If they really want the mega clash, it's got to be the balance of all this stuff. It's got to be, look, here are the four things that Poilievre is going to cut. Extend the pressure on him. Intensify it. Move it just off the capital gains, right? So here's another set of questions they won't answer. Here's another set of questions they'll try to dodge. Go after, say they're going to cut this and this and this, and these are things that benefit you. And I don't hear that message. I don't hear it effectively, sharply articulated. They need to narrow their playbook, shorten up what they're saying, and get it a lot harder. All this shit about wanting to brag about the measures and the superior brilliance of their budget. Get rid of all that. Get right, boil it down to the fight you want and deliver it in the sharpest terms you can. So, you know, we'll see. I think there's some stuff still left to work with. But those big questions, you know, are they executing against their own strategy consistently enough to break through? Are they focusing on the right demographic? I've still never been persuaded of that in terms of youth. I just don't think those people are hearing you or switching their vote. I'm not sure that any of them will vote. And are you trying to knife fight with bananas? Like, you got to sharpen it. So.
Remember back in 2008 when Barack Obama said, if you've got a business, you didn't build that? It caused an uproar because in America's culture of rugged individualism, business owners like to think they are entirely self-made. Obama was telling them that they wouldn't exist without public infrastructure built by taxpayers. And so it is here in Canada. Trucking, for example, is highly subsidized simply by the creation and maintenance of public roads. Shipyards are, to a great extent, wards of the state. Airlines fly out of passenger and freight terminals built by taxpayers, and so forth. Railways, though, are a different matter. They are the titans of our supply chains, and they literally and figuratively pull their own weight. our sponsor, CN, plows billions in revenue back into its network, building and maintaining tracks and bridges and crossings and rail yards, buying new locomotives and rail cars, and investing in innovative technology to keep its employees and the communities along its network safe. Canadian railways are heavily regulated, but receive little to no public money. The journalists covering last week's federal budget, had they looked, may have noticed there was no spending earmarked to help improve Canada's supply chain fluidity or rail safety. To be clear, this is not a complaint or sort of a pitch for government money. It's merely an acknowledgement of reality.
Yeah, as you say, I think one of the things I was really struck by, and this isn't just Freeland, this was other ministers out doing the circuit this weekend, is that they are still spending huge amounts of time sort of chippily defending their own record rather than prosecuting the case. Like, there's clearly a mindset shift that has not yet happened within cabinet about the need to go on the offense. Like, they are, their communication strategy for most of their ministers, with some, you know, some exceptions, and I think, you know, Fraser being the obvious one, is very defensive, and it just isn't punching through. Like, if you listened to the post-budget interviews over the weekend, you know, you actually had, typically the NDP person on the panel was out there punching at the Conservatives much harder about what they were going to cut in terms of dental or pharma or any of these other things that, you know, that actually have some impact, right? And I think that until they're able to actually point their guns at the Conservatives and really invest wholeheartedly in that strategy, I can't see them capitalizing on some of the opportunities that actually were created. Like, there is a moment right now where the evasiveness of the Conservatives in answering the question about what they would cut, about what they would even do on capital gains, like, there's an opening there, but they can't close on that until they buy in wholeheartedly.
But just in terms of trying to force an answer out of this, like, David, you've made the point a few times in other forums, and I very much agree with it. Most people don't know what a capital gains tax is unless they paid one. And I think like 57% of all capital gains taxes are paid by 1% of the population. And, you know, and it's like 40% is like 0.1%. Like, it's, this is, you know, not a tax measure that most Canadians understand unless they really are among the wealthiest people in the country.
And inclusion rates, Corey, how many, like, this discussion is right away missing most people. Yeah, what is an inclusion rate? Because if you're a salaried person, your salary's included.
But there's a really excellent way neighbor to talk
thinks,
about it.
But. My neighbor thinks that the tax rate is 66%. You have to say, no, that's the inclusion rate. And then try, like, it's hopeless.
There's a great communications way to talk about it, which is, do you think that somebody who makes their money from investments should be taxed in the same way that somebody who makes their money flipping burgers is? Yes or no? And if it's yes, then you're in favor. Congratulations. So the government also has to tighten up on that.
I think you need a 20-page PowerPoint to actually get people to actually understand.
Nor this man.
And that is not.
Excuse me, Young Canada, Young Canada. Okay, can everyone just take their seats? We're going to start in a moment.
Maybe the Young Entrepreneurs Club should be doing a presentation. Everyone, I don't know.
Somebody, please make a TikTok explainer. This is perfect for it.
Right.
Yeah, which is on the brink of being banned.
Like, it's just, I think, too complicated and too in the weeds. And look, and so far as this theory that the Conservatives have to answer particular questions on things, what in the past year and a half would give you the indication that there is a punishment from the Conservatives to not answer questions like this? Because the only thing I've seen is them not answering questions like this and ticking up, you know, every couple of weeks another point in the polls. So, like, I don't see.
Fill the picture. Don't ask. Tell.
It's advertising material, right, Corey? Like, okay, if the government had their shit together.
And the greater the lead, the more the scrutiny. I think will bear out.
I'm a bigger fan of asserting positions for people and then backing them up with millions of dollars of advice.
And then making them true,
as opposed to relying on Vashi and others in the media to ask these questions and then assume that the non-existent news audience out there is going to be offended at the non-answers. Look, the most people who are voting don't ever see the questions, let alone the answers. Like, it's you're shouting down a well. Like, it's not really a megaphone that's reaching a large audience. These forums just don't do that anymore. There's not enough audience there to have that function.
Well, on that note, let's move to our clipping of the day, because it follows quite directly from this conversation about advertising, right? So Robert Benzie, our old friend, reports in the Toronto Star on a new Abacus poll in Ontario. Here's a segment of the article. The Progressive Conservatives' multi-million-dollar advertising blitz is helping Premier Doug Ford and hurting Liberal leader Bonnie Crombie, a new poll suggests. In the Abacus monthly tracking survey for The Star, Ford's Tories were at 41% to 25% for Crombie's Liberals, 21% for Marit Stiles, New Democrats, and 7% for Mike Schreiner's Greens. The Liberals dipped by 2 percentage points from last month's poll, while the other three parties remained static. The Tories are broadcasting folksy one-minute spots showing Ford getting ready for work in the morning, chatting to Ontarians on the phone, and meeting a diverse range of voters to hear their concerns while acknowledging he's made mistakes. You can't always get it right. Let me tell you, when I don't, I hear from the people, the Premier says in the ad, referring to the $8.28 billion Greenbelt land swap scandal currently being investigated by the RCMP. At the same time the PC party has been broadcasting political ads paid for by donors, the government is airing taxpayer-funded commercials touting Ontario's economy and its ongoing infrastructure improvements. So they're hitting Bonnie Crombie with the partisan ads, and you're seeing the government ads everywhere. In terms of voters' sentiment toward the leaders, 35% of respondents said they had a positive impression of Ford, while 42% had a negative impression. The Liberals' Crombie was 28% positive, 32% negative, and Marit Stiles was at 27% positive, 26% negative. So, Scott, it's pretty impressive for the Ontario PCs to be over 40% in support 6 years into a mandate, especially a mandate that hasn't met with universal acclaim.
Yeah, no, there's no question. And, you know, we hear from Corey constantly about the importance of punching through and how much money it takes. You have to spill millions to get thousands. And I think, you know, we're seeing that on display. I am working under the assumption that the biggest effect of the negative advertising campaign against Bonnie isn't so much to define and drive her numbers down, but it's to stall any possibility of a bounce as people go, well, let's hear about this suburban mayor who's a woman, looks interesting, maybe a little more middle of the road. So that's a working thesis. Maybe I'm making the mistake of assuming that more people are interested in watching than even that. But, you know, it highlights the fundamental challenge, whether it's a voluntary disarmament, as we've seen at the federal level, or one that's imposed on you by circumstance and financial need at the provincial level. The challenge of not being able to meet firepower with firepower. And you know, Liberals will tell you in Ontario, it's no big deal. Of course, they're going to do it. It's predictable. Just because something's predictable doesn't mean it doesn't impact. And so it is concerning if you were the Liberals, and, you know, you're going to have to figure out ways to punch through. It doesn't have to happen tomorrow, but you're going to have to figure out ways to define yourself differently, to get noticed. And I think, you know, obviously it highlights a fundamental, irreversible fact of contemporary campaigning, particularly, I'd say, at the provincial level. You need fucking money. You know, you got to figure out how to fire up that money making engine and pour rocket fuel in it. So I don't have a lot of smart insights beyond that. And I like the Ford positive ad, you know, belly sticking out through his jacket, and hey, I'm getting in my big black SUV and bombing around and, you know, looking after shit. But my guess is that what's really what's really responsible for those numbers is the negative ad campaign that forestalls growth on the part of the Liberals and keeps the opposition parties perfectly locked in an effective statistical tie, which has got to be job number one for the Conservatives.
Yeah, Corey, I wanted to ask you about that, because running negative ads in Canada is a little bit more complicated than it is in the United States. In the United States, there's two candidates. So if you suppress the vote of one, it automatically accrues to the benefit of the other. But in Canada, with three or sometimes more parties, voters have more options. And so, I know from personal experience, that I drove voters in the 2018 campaign, for example, to the NDP rather than to us with an anti-Ford campaign. So that can happen. So my question to you is this interesting, is you're bombing Crombie. Why isn't Stiles getting a bump out of that?
Well, I think there's a few things going on. One, there's a new NDP leader that is almost completely unknown in the marketplace. And I think the benefit of Horvath, and I think the difference in terms of, you know, what the dynamic you were talking about is, she was a very well-known commodity at the time. And Merritt Stiles just isn't, in terms of, I think what the ads are doing with Crombie, they're introducing her. Like she's well known in Peel region, but almost completely unknown everywhere else in the province. And so the thing that I'm looking at more than what her plus minus is her awareness amongst voters, which has ticked up considerably. And you don't get two chances to make a first impression, as the saying goes. And, if I were to look at the federal scene...
You seem like an unlikely person to quote a dandruff commercial to me.
Yeah. I told two friends.
Exactly. And they told two friends and they told two friends. But, if the Trudeau team could invent a time machine and go back and make one change in terms of what they've done in this past term of office, I think it would be to do... to Polyev, what Ford is doing to Crombie is to make the introduction, show them who this person is, and frame them in a way that's positive for your ballot. And there's no way to go back in time and do that. And things are not being done that way in the Ontario provincial political scene. So, and I think that's to the benefit of Ford. Obviously, I do think the positive ads are more important than you indicate, Scott. Actually got a nice note from well-known liberal who shall remain nameless on the podcast saying that they thought they were 11 out of 10. I think they're good.
Because I like the ad. I just don't know that it's the most effective of the two. My guess is, can you give us insight? What do you think?
Well,
which is driving success?
I think both are important. You can't.
Okay, Melissa Lantzman, are you gonna know the tax change?
It's like choose a favorite child, Scott. It's not a fair question.
you have to do both. You can't negative your way to victory. You've got to have people who
I agree with that
are willing to go and cast a ballot for you, and you've got to maintain a voter ceiling of, I think at least 45% if you want to win in Canadian politics. And it's a lot easier if you're at 50. Like
that's why you try to keep your leader away from the negative messaging.
That's right.
Yep. And, right. What's the most important thing? It's about motive, and those ads have to be genuine. I think those are good ads because they are genuinely, reflective of who Ford is as a leader. And I think it also presses, you pushed on the one key line, it presses on what I think most Ontarians think is his greatest feature. Like it's the ability to course correct, the ability to say, oops, you really didn't like that, and I'm gonna change course. That is very popular with nonpartisan, swing voters. They don't want to wait for election day to boot your ass out of government if you do something they don't like.
I'm convinced the feds would have more credibility on housing, Corey. I'm convinced the feds would have more credibility on housing if they had acknowledged that they dropped the ball in the first instance.
You have to, right? Because that is where, like, if you don't acknowledge that, people aren't going to listen to anything you have to say after that point. It's the on ramp to having a conversation about anything.
Right. Every day, Canada's 19 nuclear reactors reliably generate 15% of Canada's electricity, all without emitting any greenhouse gases. In fact, nuclear power is Canada's second largest source of GHG-free electricity. In Ontario, nuclear power plays an even bigger role, with over half of its electricity coming from nuclear. And when you dig deeper, looking at the entire life cycle and factoring in activities like plant operations and mining, nuclear power is the lowest carbon-intensive source of electricity generation per megawatt hour of electricity generated. Today's podcast sponsor, Bruce Power, is one of the world's largest nuclear generating facilities, located in Tiverton, Ontario, and responsible for avoiding about 19 million tons of greenhouse gases a year. While the company produces large volumes of emissions-free electricity, critical to Ontario staying off coal, as well as continued system reliability, in 2021, Bruce Power became the first nuclear operator in North America to commit to achieving net zero greenhouse gases from site operations by 2027. That means it minimizes and offsets emissions from routine undertakings such as vehicles, machinery, buildings, and equipment to get to net zero status by 2027. And with investments being made to increase the electricity output from the Bruce Power site, which would further displace GHG emissions from Ontario's electricity sector, Bruce Power worked collaboratively to create the first carbon offset protocol for nuclear generation to help industries reach their own net zero goals. So what does it all add up to? By increasing the amount of clean energy it produces, Bruce Power is helping to decarbonize the economy and meet the increasing demand for electricity as more businesses and consumers turn to electrification. Jordan, do you see any way that this Ontario race tightens up over the next couple of years, or are we headed toward a blowout?
No, I believe in nothing but possibility in Ontario. You know, I think that's requisite.
Well,
right?
It's a place to grow.
All right, sorry, I'm not looking for NDP unicorns and sky castles here.
I offer you nothing but possibility. No, listen, I think actually the possibility lies in what is unsaid in Corey's comment about the positive ad, which is not just that it's about a reason to give people to vote for Ford. They also have to pay attention to Ford's negatives, which are a vulnerability. And so positive advertising there, you know, and I do want to say, like, I think that piece of creative, that ad, is so well done. Like, it's really, if you haven't seen it, go watch it, because this is really genius. The ability to take what should be absolutely government ending boondoggles, you know, scandals, flip-flops, all of this stuff, and to morph it into a positive attribute for your principal is, like, this is really good. And I do think that government should take a note on it. But the fact remains that Ford is vulnerable. He's vulnerable on the notion that he rewards his insider friends. He's vulnerable on the flip-flops if they don't happen in exactly the right way. And he's vulnerable also on some of his things of his own doing, you know, a $9.8 billion deficit at a moment when people are becoming more concerned about spending. Like, some of these things can come back to bite him. I do think that there are vulnerabilities there. And I think that Ford is often his own worst enemy, and that in the long run has the greatest likelihood of opening up some possibility for either the NDP or for Crombie to kind of break out. I think that the negative advertising has played certainly a big part in preventing the bump, but I'd also want to point out that there was no evidence of a bump prior to the negative advertising also. Like, she was flat. She was flat out the gate. So there is definitely a risk there for the Liberals that this dog don't hunt in terms of what she was elected leader to do. And I'm not sure that they've actually sorted out how to spin her positives into broader recognition across the province. The New Democrats, though, they have a challenge. They don't have the revenue to sort of hemorrhage money into ad campaigns, as we've seen the Conservatives do. And there's no question that Marit Stiles needs to be better known. She needs to get out of Queen's Park. She needs to be going out and having some of these events, like she was out last week in Wilmot doing a great event in rural Ontario, packing rooms to overflow. That is the stuff she needs to be spending her time doing, not spending her time in Queen's Park, and certainly not getting lost in internal debates and caucus. So I think that if they're able to exercise some discipline on that and be smart about the use of their official opposition resources while they have it, then that will advantage them over the long run as well. So I think that there's definitely possibility for change in this. I don't think it's baked in at all, but there's no question that that the ad campaigns have really set the table favorably for Ford. And I think like that's smart strategy.
You know, I think I'm just going to say, I think we're underselling Ford a little bit here and overselling advertising a little bit here because the product has to work. I mean, in order for advertising to be successful. The same agency, which is a really good agency that is doing Ford's work, is also doing Kevin Falcon's work, right? And he's circling the drain about to go down despite a significant advertising spend. So people aren't responding the same way to Kevin Falcon that they are to Doug Ford. And if David Rosenberg and Ben Simon Byrne had put Michael Ignatieff on an escalator, it wouldn't likely have worked the same way it worked with Justin Trudeau on an escalator. So the product does matter. And I wonder whether when you're dealing with Ford, whether his favorables, unfavorables don't mean something different than they normally do, because he's got pretty high negative pretty high negatives personally to be at this place in voter intent. So I'm wondering whether people are more comfortable with him than the negatives led on.
I think it's what Corey said. It goes to motive, right? That's his strength, is that because he's able to leverage the idea that when he flip-flops, when he does these things, it's because it's the people wanted it and it's the right decision. So it's a very clever attribute that he's been able to attach to himself. Yeah.
Folks, I'm planning to three times this coming year just so you can win the reward of watching me reverse myself. Well,
and here's my cell number.
Government I'm offering.
I think you're focusing on the wrong thing. And what the difference between, say, Ford and Harper or someone like that is, you know, he doesn't look like he's out there trying to jam his thumb in people's eyes. I think that is often being the case with a number of conservative leaders. Like you could look at, Harris, if you want another provincial conservative, where it seemed like there is a fuck you, it doesn't matter, you know, you're with me or you're against me. I'm doing this come hell or high water, you know, like an inflexibility and at times an element of mean-spiritedness that Ford just lacks. Like, you know, he wants people to like him. And I don't think that's a flaw. I think that's a feature. So he comes across differently. So yes, there's a portion of the public that dislike Ford intensely, and they would dislike any conservative leader intensely, but it's not the positives. Like there's, you know, big Ford boosters, but there's like 20-25% of people who are kind of in the middle, and they're not going to say to a pollster, I like them, and they're not going to say to a pollster, I dislike them, but they're all accessible voters. And a bunch of those accessible voters are saying today that they would vote for him. And so I just don't think he comes across as divisive as a lot of other conservatives do.
The finance minister's shoes may change, but one thing remains the same. Budgets impact how Canadians invest. Last year's announced the launch of the first home savings account, and this year's nearly doubled the RRSP withdrawal limit for first-time home buyers. More choice is good news, but people, especially young people, might still feel overwhelmed by the sheer range of investing options. RRSPs, TFSAs, FHSAs, the list goes on. Where do you even start? Well, when it comes to saving and investing, the smartest option is to start early and stick to your plan. Wealthsimple was founded to help Canadians do just that. Their helpful advisors, educational resources, and user-friendly experience simplify investing for everyone. Plus, their low fees mean you get to keep more of your money. That's why Wealthsimple serves more than 3 million Canadians, including nearly 1 in 5 adults under 40, many of them first-time investors. At the end of the day, the government may give you more options to invest. Wealthsimple makes it easy to actually do it.
I'll just add this as a last denouement. It's the first and last time I'm ever going to say this in a public arena. Because I do think that Bonnie has lots of upside potential. I do think that she arrives with a set of ingredients that that could add up to success. So I don't want this to be seen as speaking to her detriment. But Ford has done something that I think, at least when I teach this course that I do at Queen's on government and political communications, that I tell students very rarely occurs. And he's one of only a couple of examples that I can think of in Canadian history who have done this. And that is, he's reframed himself. It's so hard once a frame is set on your political identity to alter that. And when you think
he's
about...
He's de-Frenched himself.
Yes. Yeah, but I think it goes back to that. If you think about... Our first familiarity in Ontario with Doug Ford was as Rob Ford's meaner, bigger, nastier brother. He was the heavy. He was the bully. Rob Ford was the lovable fuck up. And people were like, God, you know, he works hard. He shakes hands. He wants to. He's friendly. And yes, he screws up. And yes, he makes terrible mistakes. But God, you know, he's Chris Farley. He's trying hard. He wants to be liked. As Doug was his wingman who was picking off people that were criticizing his brother. And he was the bully. And that's how he positioned himself. That's how he was positioned. And that was his political identity. And you look a decade later or more now, and we find ourselves in this situation where you can do an ad about him getting into an SUV, talking about he goes to work in the morning. And yeah, I fuck up sometimes, but by golly, you know, I just pick myself up and try harder tomorrow. And people are loving it. And that is an astonishing achievement to get framed and then over the course of a number of years, be reframed, win two elections, and halfway through your second mandate, be defined in that way and have numbers of
the
kind.
And like with the record, like this is the genius of it. It's an inoculation seemingly for almost everything. So
that's a compliment to you, Corey, and the whole team, yeah. But it's also a remarkable achievement on the part of the premier himself, because it means that he's shown the discipline and humility to say, all right, I'm going to stop doing some things and try to do others. And he succeeded.
Well, I'll make one more point around this, and it's about Crombie. And it's to point out that she's doing 6 points worse than Stephen Del Duca was at this point in his leadership. I don't think that there's a lot of indication.
Put her in a fishing vest, and she's going to rocket.
But I think there's a fundamental underlying reality. Like, I think she's, you know, I think you like her more because she's more like a Martin liberal in terms of what some of her impulses are. I think that the Liberal Party in Ontario.
She was actually a Martin Liberal. She got elected.
Well, yeah. But like she has gravitated, the party has gravitated way more to the left over the last 20 years. And I think the base of that party is way more urban. It's way more woke. It's focused on a different set of issues. And I don't think she connects particularly well to the Liberal base. I think she has more problems with the core base of the Liberal Party than she does with swing voters in some respects. And I think the way she campaigns is demonstrative of that. I think it's like it's a tour of cocktail parties in downtown Toronto as opposed to going out and doing like field organizing and, you know, trying to build a political organization from the ground up. I think it's more like the martini circuit as opposed to the small town hall circuit. And, you know, and I think that's
sort
of her impulse.
She should have two priorities, money and candidates.
Mm-hmm.
Money and candidates. I'm just going to say, all of you accursed out there, as a rule of general application, and the three of you can tell me I'm wrong if you want, but I'm just going to say, as a rule of general application, apologies and politics are good. And they work. And if you think how often a sincere, heartfelt apology is necessary to maintain an important relationship in your life, well, a relationship with a voter is no different. You're either honest with them or you're not honest with them.
I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
I would say sincerity is the key word in that, because that is the difference between apologies done well and faceplants.
Well, how well is the crusade of gaslighting by the federal Liberal Party working? No, the things that you see as obvious problems aren't real. The only problem is your perspective. Like it's like a marriage on the ropes. Like it's not good.
I don't know why people in politics are so afraid of doing it. It really is an opportunity for you to reestablish a connection with somebody.
I think the problem on the federal level is that the prime minister himself doesn't feel that he has anything to apologize for. And right. And if that, and until that changes, that strategy can't lift off.
All right. Our last item for today, the unusually prominent on this podcast, Newfoundland Premier Andrew Fury.
Andrew.
Yeah. All right. He kind of busted up budget day when he launched a broadside at Justin Trudeau after losing a seat in a by-election out in Newfoundland. Fury has been trying really hard to distinguish himself from Trudeau so as not to get caught under the waves. Corey, I think we've all been in a position where we were working for a provincial party and the federal party was dragging us down, or we were working for the federal party and a provincial party was a drag on us. But there's a lot of brand overlap between federal and provincial parties in Canada, and it's very difficult to run down the federal Liberal brand, for example, without damaging the Newfoundland Liberal brand, in my experience. It's a very tricky thing to do. What are your thoughts about it?
It is tricky, but I'm going to pull out a quote from, I don't think he ever invented this. Well, I know he didn't invent this saying, but it was a favorite of his. Patrick Muttart used to like to say, you can't fatten the pig on market day. And I think that is so true in terms of comms and branding. There is a way to create space between federal and provincial parties, and that is not something you do in a short period of time, and there's got to be a lot of data points, and you know it takes a lot of ocean to turn that aircraft carrier around. It can be done, but it's not a couple of barbs and press releases. I think at this point in their mandate, it looks more like a deathbed conversion than a genuine finding of faith. Like it's too little too late, I think, to execute very cleanly. That said, you know, what alternative does he have? Like, you know, the Liberal Party is tied to carbon tax, and carbon tax is tied to an anchor going to the bottom of the ocean. So, you know, if you're not, you know, trying to cut the chain attached to your ankle, I don't know what you're doing. So, like, I think he's, you know, I think he's, he, I don't think he has an alternative, but, you know, if I were to give advice, I would be looking for more than points of differentiation than that one. And you're going to have to articulate why you're coming to this point now and try to flesh that argument out in a little more fulsome manner, because right now it looks like deathbed conversion to me.
Scott, where are you at on this?
A couple things. First of all, Fury is doing this because he has to. Let's be honest. He's a very comfortable federal Liberal, very close to those guys, and he is what you would call a good Liberal. He's a full-on partisan and has a partisan past. His dad is a wonderful guy. And so he's doing this out of necessity, not out of, not out of impulse. I'm sure he's sincerely frosted about the state of the carbon tax discussion and what it's doing to him and his government, and probably looking around thinking about what it's going to do to his friends who have federal seats in Newfoundland. The one thing I would say to your question, David, is I think it's easier to create distinction on brand politically in a smaller political community than a larger one. So we, in our previous discussion, one factor we did not mention that is, you know, going to harm Bonnie are the federal Liberals, and it's clear that that's going to have there is a lot of overlap in brand perception in a province like Ontario. There's a reason that the ad calls her Carbon Queen over and over and over again, and I noticed cartoonishly the Premier doing so at the microphone with the barest of props the other day. So I think it's easier to do it in a smaller political community where people can make those distinctions and there's a little bit more familiarity with the players. But, you know, I was saying something all this past week that I'm starting to rethink. And what I was saying all last week, and it was prompted by the story about Dominic LeBlanc, and, you know, like, oh, is somebody like starting to think about leadership and all that? And my argument was, like, I don't know, you know, like, what I do know for sure is there's no real internal culture within the Federal Liberal Party of agitation. There's not really any impulse or any reservoir of let's push Trudeau out. One thing I would say,
zero, by the way, zero. Zero. They're all of the view, and it's amazing. And you know, they're all of the view that he brung them. And yes, they're going to ride it out with
that's
him.
Correct. If you look at what Ignatieff did, you know, the escalator he was on in 2011 went right to the basement. And so, you know, it was left to Trudeau to resuscitate that brand in an astonishing historic fashion as he did. So you get zero of that. I wonder if a little bit of what we're seeing here, I wonder if it will cause some of those folks to think, jeepers, creepers, maybe we've got to get on this bandwagon. You know, at what point do people start to think individually? But I'm not making any predictions here. It just is causing me to think about it. The last thing I would say is just a small thing. I love, did you know, did you catch the specific complaint that Fury made?
He's sclerotic.
You can take the premier out of the doctor's office, but you can't take the doctor out of the premier. Sclerotic.
I love the fact that he threw a $100 word at Trudeau. It was awesome. Jordan? This is an issue, this federal-provincial dynamic, that the NDP has struggled with, like all parties throughout its history, but right now appears to be managing but reasonably well, if you look at Manitoba and British Columbia, where they're managing to have provincial parties that are far more popular than the federal party is. Perhaps it's not going as well in Saskatchewan and maybe not in Alberta. In terms of that federal-provincial overhang. What are your thoughts from your experience about how you can best disentangle without brand damage?
Yeah. So I think that Scott makes an important point about smaller markets. I think that it doesn't play equally federally as it does provincially, right? And so I think that in that relationship, there always has to be a recognition that the federal brand impact on the provincial brand can be much larger than the impact of a federal section making a move against a federal brand. So I think that's always something to bear in mind in that relationship. And look, I think, you know, and you're right to point, over the course of the party's history, there's been a lot of conflict. And I certainly remember very well the last time the Manitoba NDP was in government, you know, we would pull out a folio when they came to town because they were always coming to Ottawa to rail against us basically on crime policy. Right. And it was very normal, and it was very, and that was just part of the dynamic. And I think that these disagreements don't have to be damaging mutually. And in fact, often they can be somewhat negotiated, right? Like, everybody understands the political reality that each other is operating in. And I think that it works best when there's good communication, when people aren't surprised about a move that's going to be made, and everyone gets to go out and say their piece and move on. And in that instance, I think it can be mutually beneficial. You know, I think that, for example, during the Notley government, the friction that she regularly had with the federal party benefited her. That was important. She needed that space, right? And I don't think it really did much harm to.
But they are still considering whether or not they should formally disengage with the federal party.
Yeah, but fairness, like, you're in the midst of a leadership race, like, that all those ideas are fair game, and I think that, you know, let's see where the conclusion comes on that, and you know, that'll be a different discussion if and when it comes up. But I think that what you see, when you see it work well, it happens with good communication and with good warning. And those disagreements don't need to be damaging. And they can be actually vital for the political life, particularly of the provincial section. So I think the difference that you see here is that it's a particularly damaging divergence for the federal Liberals because, like, exactly because of what you were talking about, that Andrew Fury is, like, he's not an outsider in any sense to federal Liberal politics. Like, he's very close to the Prime Minister. And I think that with no knowledge about what their relationship looks like at this point, the tone of it, which is personal, suggests to me that it's not something that is happening with good communication and warning and all of those other things that you might wish for. And so the timing of it is the third piece that suggests that this isn't something coordinated, because if you're going to punch a friend, you don't do it like on what their, you know, on their birthday, right? Like, you don't do it on around budget day. Like, you're not trying to harm them at a moment where they need to have a pretty clean field. So yeah, I think that there are better and worse ways to have this divergence. And I think that what you're seeing right now in Newfoundland is certainly one of the more challenging formulations.
I think the problem is way more acute for the NDP in terms of this than it is for other parties. And the reason is really simple. The federal NDP polls at less than half of what it does in the provinces where it vies for government, and has a support base that is way more narrow and with way less growth potential. So, you know, if you have federal leaders that are more, you know, downtown, large urban and Eastern Canadian in terms of their orientation, and then you have markets where they vie for government, which are predominantly in Western Canada, and where support levels are, you know, more than 2x what they are at the federal level, you know, which one is more important to distance yourself from? Like, I don't think it's possible to get elected in BC or Saskatchewan or Manitoba or Alberta with a Jagmeet Singh agenda. Like, it's too narrow.
I think Corey's overstating the point.
But that's what the numbers are consistently. And so who has to distance themselves from
that? But the reality doesn't bear that out. There's a reason that west of Ontario, the NDP is far more competitive than the Liberals.
Because they don't look at all.
But like it's despite the federal party, not because of the federal party. They're a ballot drag.
The federal party is a ballot drag in every one of those provinces, and like a 2x or greater ballot drag.
Well, I think, yeah, I agree with you that the issue of whether the federal leader resonates in those areas ebbs and flows certainly depends on the leader. But I think that it speaks to the enduring winability that the party has out there.
It hasn't ebbed and flowed in the last three decades. It's only
Nolly didn't wear too many three-piece suits, did she? I'm trying to remember.
not as good a Rolex collection.
Ready for government, my friends.
I will bet a lot of money that Jagmeet Singh does not step foot in the province of Saskatchewan between now and the provincial election.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think he would be a distraction there. And I think that, I don't think you'll see him there.
All right. Mr. Pinsent is anxious to move on to whatever he's got doing for the rest of the day. So let's get to our Hey Yous.
Ladies and gentlemen, please return to your seats. The Hey Yous are about to begin.
Who wants to start?
Well, mine folds into what we were just talking about, so I'll go first. So my Hey You is to Kevin Falcon. You have an opportunity to
either distance yourself from the carbon tax.
Yeah, well, I think he's either got to swallow himself whole on the carbon tax and come out against it, or he is on a one-way track to not being the party leader and not having a party there to lead. I think it's a pull the fire alarm existential crisis for them at this point.
No kidding.
And they are going to cease to exist if they don't do this. They went through this ill-conceived rebranding to jettison the word Liberal from their party name. Didn't rebrand properly. Didn't do any of that. That ship sailed. But they're going to hang on like a life preserver to the largest, most unpopular defining issue for the Liberals federally, being a carbon tax. It's like, I think you let go of the wrong thing. He has welded himself to that anvil that we were talking about that Fury is trying to cut his leg off of. And it's the wrong decision. I think it's now or never. Distance yourself from a carbon tax or get ready for the inevitable coup de grace that's coming your way.
Hey Corey, how does that guy get out of bed in the morning? Like, if you were on the verge of destroying your plan to rebrand this thing and reshape it, and you lead it, was going to lead to the complete end of the political party, wouldn't you just be fucking lying under the covers with your?
I would be listening to this podcast and taking the advice of Corey tonight. That's what I would be doing.
All right, who's going to hate you?
I'll go. And also somebody, a name that was mentioned earlier, my Hey Yous to John Manley. Listen, You go, Gray girl. You keep up this fight on the capital gains exemption. You give, you give the bejesus to the government. And you know, the other day, Manley did this interview, and you were highlighting it, David, where he unveiled his Seinfeld thesis, super original, which was that, you know, Seinfeld lasted 9 years, all great shows and things last 9 years, and therefore, like, you know, it's time to wrap it up for the Trudeau government. And that's much appreciated because, you know, I mean, well, first of all, if federal politics is an episode of Seinfeld, Manly is Newman, okay? So, but it's much appreciated his perspective because, you know, he's got political instincts as sharp as cottage cheese. But I also want to highlight this fact, okay? People always go, oh, well, maybe, you know, he's not as good at politics, but, you know, like, you know, man of substance. And so, really? When is this guy ever right? When is this guy? He is the crowned king of conventional wisdom. When is he ever right? I'll remind Corey. In 2008, Stephen Harper thought, well, there's one good liberal. I'll pick Manley and ask him to chair this report on how we get out of this nightmare muskeg of Afghanistan. And his suggestion, his studied recommendation, and I shit you not, in 2008, was that we can extricate ourselves as a Western world from Afghanistan with the application of 1,000, that's 10 times 100, 1,000 additional troops and a helicopter. That was his, so one more year, 1,000 people and a helicopter. This is a guy who went and did a national media interview at one point earlier in his political career where he talked about taping up his nipples in order to keep them from suffering from abrasion. Okay, good. That's that shows a lot of weight. You go after this capital gains exemption, you give Trudeau the bejesus, and you deliver to the government exactly the fight that Polyev is refusing to give. Maybe you can resuscitate this political fight and help the Liberals in spite of yourself and your dreadful instincts.
I'm really disappointed that your list of manly shittiness was so truncated. There's so many other things.
It seemed very short, really. Yeah.
Listen, if we want to do a bonus episode for people, I'm in.
You're being very uncharitable, Scott. In fairness, the one helicopter was Airwolf. And if you'd been around in the 80s, you would understand how much that brings to the table.
That's so staggering.
So, I really appreciate
it. Being taken seriously.
That was Seinfeld reference. Like, he's just so in touch with the kids these days. You know? I mean, I know.
Ooh, yeah. Connecting. Exactly.
Just bringing that real talk. Love it.
Took him 30 years to come up with that theory since Seinfeld went off the air. All right, Jordan, what's your hey you?
So I am going to hew close to my policy wonk past, and I'm going to have an earnest hey you. I really enjoyed your policy show. I thought with Tyler and Jen and Sean Spear, I thought it's a really good listen, so everybody should take some time to listen to it. But I wanted to pick up on one thing in the budget that I think hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but is worthwhile just sort of for its like sheer shittiness. And this is so my hey you is going out to the federal Liberals who had the undesirable job of crafting this monstrosity. And it is around the disability tax credit. So this is something that I think we can all across party lines agree that, you know, we have a problem in Canada. There's 1.5 million people with disability living in absolutely crushing poverty. This is a problem that this particular government did promise to solve. They promised to solve it. And they came back with a disability tax credit after hyping it and going to the community and engaging with them for years, of a paltry $200 a month. And this has been such a bitter disappointment to people who have been waiting for that as a lifeline. And my hey you is that, look, there's a time and place for incrementalism. There really is. But let me tell you, it is not in the fucking dying days, in the dying days of your government, with a community that has been waiting, that so urgently needs this. I think this was just such a shit thing to do. And that's really my hey you. You had an opportunity to actually solve a problem here. And instead you just threw peanuts at people. And I think it's really shitty. That's my hey you.
Yeah. I don't really realize whether Canadians appreciate how likely a disabled person is to live in poverty.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, the numbers are just stunning. It's almost half are low income. Right. And this is not like warm and fuzzy social policy. This is economic policy. These are folks that absolutely deserve and need to be a part of our economy and participating. And anyway, I think it was just such a shit move. You're splashing out money left, right and center. You could have fixed this.
Terrible expectations management, though, I think. Like, they really did rev that community up with an expectation of something more. I think if they'd come in and said, you know, we are going to do something incremental, then I don't think you would have seen the level of disappointment from that community that you saw.
Well, they put in place legislation without funding a couple of years ago, and the legislation promised to raise people out of poverty.
Yeah, so, that's it, exactly. And right. They've come nowhere close to that.
Yeah. So the opposite, amped it up.
My AU goes out to, and in all full disclosure, he's a personal friend, my AU goes out to Andrew Bevin. This budget may or may not work for the government. Time will tell. No facts in the future, as Ellie likes to say. But it certainly has given the government itself energy and life. And I can tell that people believe in this inside the government, that people think they've got a plan that they can stand behind and believe in and may work politically. And there's energy in the place. And that's a result of a lot of people's work. The minister obviously worked hard on this budget. The prime minister's office obviously worked hard on this budget. Lots of people, other ministers. But the X factor seems to be Andrew coming in as the minister's chief of staff. And I saw him do this with Kathleen Wynne in 2014. He's extremely expert at taking a political brief and forcing the system to produce the budget that deals with that. And so I think that to the extent possible, he's done that this time. And to the extent that we are talking about whether the Liberal strategy will work as opposed to why don't the Liberals have a strategy, I think a lot of that goes out to Bevin. So, hey, you. All right, folks, that is the show for this week. I want to thank Corey and Jordan and Scott for being here with me again. It's always fun to have this virtual morning coffee around. I want to thank our presenting sponsor, TELUS, our sponsors, CN, Bruce Power, and Wealth Simple. And all of you accursed for watching or listening today. We'll see you next week with more of the Curse of Politics. In the meantime, stay safe out there.